Welcome back to Bush and Banner. It has been a long hiatus, but we are back. Welcome to your...
Damn it.
We are... I'm a co-host. So bad.
Wait, before we started recording, Jen said, let me handle it. I can do this intro. Let me handle it. And she's not handling it.
I'm sweating. Why is this so nerve-wracking? Okay. Welcome back to Bush and Banter, the adventure podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Jennifer Mabus, and I am joined with the other fabulous part of this podcast, Diana Carmella.
The better part.
Anyway, welcome back. We have been gone for... a few months, and yeah. I'm very excited to be back. Are you excited to be back?
I'm really excited. Yeah, you got some big news before we get into this, because this is a great episode, but you got to, what's your big news, Jen?
I'm very excited to report.
You're not pregnant again, right?
No. My big news is that me and my family moved to Reno, Nevada. So I am on the West Coast, same time zone as Diana, so we don't need to coordinate three different time zones when we interview guests, which is really nice.
Thank God.
But yeah, I mean, technically I'm in Sparks, Nevada, but right outside of Lake Tahoe. So really excited to be back where I grew up and next to some mountains.
That's great, Jen.
Yes, I am a West Coast girl. So we're really excited to be here. And this just means you and I get to, you know, fly to each other and bug each other in person a lot more.
Dang it. That's what I was hoping you wouldn't say.
We have a lot of great episodes coming out the next few months. We've been, once again, working hard. We always like to say that. Yeah, we're going to be putting out some content more consistently, which I'm really excited about. But yeah, who is on our docket today, Diane? Who are we launching this new...
chapter in our lives?
Like, yes,
who's
yes.
Who's the captain of our sinking ship right now?
It is sinking, but this guest is going to help us dump the water out. And save us.
If I was in a sinking boat, this is the woman that I would want in that sinking boat with me, because I know she can get me home. This episode, we wanted to put this one out first because we have a lot of individuals going out on their summer adventures. And what happens when you go out on your summer adventures? Some of you get lost, like me. So we thought it'd be really beneficial to put out an episode on survival and surviving if you got seriously, seriously lost. And our guest today is, I honestly would say she is one of the most qualified in the business of surviving. And yeah, she's amazing. So I'm pretty excited.
Yeah, I don't know how we scored this one, but we did. I'm completely stoked to talk to this person. Yeah, this is the person that you want to learn from for anything wilderness survival. And I can't believe that this is our first guest. Diana, who do we have on the show?
Our guest today is a former U.S. military SEER specialist. SEER stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. She has taught members of the military how to stay alive and return home if they were shot down behind enemy lines. She has worked for over a decade in wilderness therapy, was a contestant on the hit TV show Alone, and has her very own masterclass in wilderness survival. Today, she is still teaching individuals not only how to survive, but develop a deep love and appreciation for the great outdoors with an array of in-person classes and collaborations. She is a top-notch survival expert, and I'm very happy I got to spend some time with her at the end of last year. So yeah, sit back, relax, but also pay attention because this episode could very well save your life. I feel like I say that often, but this time we're not joking about it. So Jen, are you ready?
I am ready. Let's do this.
Please welcome to the program, Jessie Krebs.
Jessie, welcome to Bush and Banner. Thank you so much for being here. We love to ask our guests where they are recording from. So where are you in the world today?
I am recording from Westminster, Colorado, so just north of downtown Denver, and we have had like, oh, probably close to 6 inches of snowfall since last night, so it's a nice wintry day outside.
I love it.
Jesse, I want to start this out by saying what a fantastic time I had meeting you last August for the Wild Woman on the Water with you and Callie Russell, both you guys alone contestants. That whole experience, I was telling Jen about it, how you got this group of, I think it was like 16 women together. And it was just this week of like you as, you know, teaching us how to survive, you know, in the woods, and Callie teaching us all the ancestral living skills. And we got this roadkill deer. And it was just like this insane experience. And I would use the word transformative in a way that seeing like these women come in from like having never camped before. And then at the very end, literally in tears, saying goodbye to you and Callie. I'm just curious, what did you think of the experience?
Yeah, I actually was in tears too, Diana. I'm getting a little teary-eyed now just thinking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, I feel so honored to be in that position. And I know Callie does too, just to be in a position where people, women who do feel like, oh, I don't know, you know, I've always wanted to do this, but I don't know. And having them trust us yes. enough to come out, like to spend the money, to take the time to come out and just spend time with us and to just take that leap, that faith of, I think this is what I'm meant to do. This is what I need to do right now. And just making that jump. So I feel so honored to have that happen. And inevitably, the women who show up are just amazing in so many ways, you know, yeah. and many of them don't even, I think, realize just how amazing they are. And I feel like seeing the other women that come and seeing the reflection of themselves in the women around them, it's just, yeah, it's so powerful and so beautiful. And the fun, you know, the singing, the dancing, the goofing off, so it's just, it's a beautiful experience. And I feel, I am tired usually at the end of them, but it's just, it's a good tired. It's like, that feels like a job well done. And just watching everyone walk away with so much and having connections then, you know, forever.
Oh,
it's like
yeah.
anytime you want to, you know, any student like, okay, give me a call, you know, give me an email, text something. If something's coming up or you need something or you want to talk or anything's going on. So it's a wonderful network that we're forming. And I love this type of class versus so often people have the impression of you're going to a survival school.
Yeah. You got to put like mud on your face with your paint.
Yes, yes. You're going to be in the mud, crawl, maggot, you know. You're going to have these, this insane, you know, which that does have a place for some people. But that's not what all survival skills in schools need to be, right? We can go out there and have a lot of fun. And so I love that we can start to transform that mindset and say you can learn these skills without all that.
Yeah, I was blown away by we got this roadkill deer delivered to us. And, you know, you and Callie were like, we're going to, you know, but, you know, cut the deer up and we're going to show you what to do with the skin and what to do with the meat. And we're going to make jerky. And we did this at night with headlamps on. And, you know, I don't eat meat, but I'm like, I'm very, very fascinated. I was blown away by these women who are coming from cities who've never seen this before, put their headlamps on and get in there and want to cut the deer up and want to learn. I was so, they blew my mind, you know? And I'm just like in the corner, like I got to the point, I think the second leg, I was like, I think I need to like, I got to take a step back because I'm starting to get queasy, but they were right in there and they wanted to learn. And I want to say when those women left that camp with you and Callie, I want to say at least more than half, you could tell are like rethinking their lives. And rethinking like what I want more of this. How do I get more of this into my life being in nature like that? So it was very transformative. And I highly recommend this. I don't know if you guys are doing it again this year, but like it was one of the best experiences of my life. So I just wanted to thank you because it was incredible. And yeah, so
I know Diana was telling me about it. And I was a little jealous. About literally the same time she was in Montana, I was giving birth. So I was having my own wild woman experience, you know.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. We did interview Callie, you know, last year. And, you know, I've just briefly met you, but just your energy and Callie's energy, what I'm getting already is that you guys come from such a non-judgmental place and it's like non-intimidating. And I think that's a huge thing for people to want to learn about how to skin a deer and, you know, survive in the wilderness and all these different scenarios is not feeling intimidated or they're not capable. And just you and Callie just seem to have this presence of truly caring about people learning and educating. And I think that's really important. And I would love to do a class. I would love, if you guys are doing it, continue to do it. I'm definitely going to check it out.
Yes. You would do really well, Jen. Jen did the Pacific Crest Trail. So she's been out there. She knows what she's doing.
And I eat meat. So I'd be in there skinning that deer.
Take the blood and like smear it on your cheeks. Yes. I could see you doing that.
So Jesse, I really want to get into this. So you were in the Air Force. Tell me about when did the survival aspect start for you and how did the Air Force shape you?
Yeah, good question. I was raised, thankfully, by a very powerful, beautiful, amazing woman. She raised me as a single mom, basically. And so she was my first introduction. She loves the outdoors. She had a horse when she was younger and lived out sort of in the woods on a farm. And so she would go horseback riding. And so she was really my introduction. And I grew up, my first initial years were out on a farm with she and her father, my grandpa. So he was sort of my male role model for my first few years. And that got me the first connection in a way. However, my grandmother's, so my mom's mom's, her second husband, she left my biological grandfather and married again. And he unfortunately was a pedophile. And so she, not knowing, would drop me off with her mother and her mother's new husband, and he would do what pedophiles do. And for me, I would, so this started in infancy, and my earliest memories are about 3 or 4 years old. And so I would escape out of the house as quickly as I was able, and I would spend all day outside. I would spend every moment I had outside just to get away. And so the wilderness was my refuge, right? Getting outside, climbing trees. And we were pretty remote. Like, it was a little town in Michigan. So it was a ways out there. So there was lots of wildlife and there were ponds and creeks. And so that was my safety. And I felt much more comfortable and safe out there. So that's where it really started. And my mom and I had always talked about, hey, let's, you know, if we ever had enough money, we'd go on one of those desert island experiences where, you know, they give you a knife and a canteen and you got to stay out there for a week. You know, we thought that would just be so much fun. Uh-huh. And so when I joined the military, I joined the Air Force at 18, and I had gone in to be a mechanic. And I think it was the 15th day of training, they showed specialty fields. And one of them was SEER training, dun, dun, dun. And it's survival, evasion, resistance, and escape. And all the video of it was all outdoors. It was up in Washington State, and it's gorgeous, and mountains, and green. And I'm like, holy cow, that's like my dream come true. Like, I already feel so much comfort in the wilderness, and they're going to teach me how to survive in any climate all around the planet, like anywhere, like, whoa,
that's awesome.
This is epic. So I heard about teach me how to survive. I didn't really pay attention to teaching me to teach part. I was painfully shy. I spoke in a whisper. When I was introduced to new people, I walked extremely pigeon-toed, had my head down. I would talk in a whisper. I would try to fade in the background, right? People aren't safe. Emotions aren't safe. I had trauma. I just don't want to be seen.
Right.
So it was kind of this interesting contradiction. So I get up to the school and I'm like, okay, I really want this. And they're like, okay, you got to learn how to teach. And I'm like, what? Wait a minute. And so I heard a lot of, you know, from 6 inches away, use your instructor voice.
You know? Oh my God.
Yes, Sergeant. Right. And so they had their work cut out for them. But it was, extremely transformative for me. So I was learning these amazing skills and learning how to gain in confidence, right? They were a huge confidence boost for me. The emotions inside didn't change, But my exterior, my confidence, and my outward appearance changed a lot. And so I really got pretty bossy, actually.
Yeah. Yes.
One thing to the other. So that was my introduction. It was awesome.
She is bossy. Like, it's
assertive. I like that word. Assertive.
I'm thinking like for the Wild Woman on the Water when like, there was a rainstorm coming in, like it was coming in and like you were in Cali, you're like, all right, we got to get, tarps up. And I'm like, tarps? I mean, shouldn't we check into a hotel? This looks really bad. And you're just
like we gotta go.
I gotta call an Uber to get me out of here. But I remember you were like, all right, you stake this down. You get up on that tree, tie the slip knot through the loophole, and then come and string it up here. Do it. All right, you there. And then like it worked. And we got this amazingly big tarp up. But I'm like, wow, this is like, I've never seen anything like this before. I would have literally left and checked into like a hotel. And but it was great. I like, wow, she's like, yes.
Clear instructions, which is important. No confusion in the moment.
Yeah.
Did you go through hypothermia training when you were in the Air Force?
Yeah, I don't know that it was intended that way.
Oh,
but that's what came out of it for me.
Can you tell us about that, because that's wild.
yeah, it was pretty interesting. So there's a part where they're teaching you interrogation, how to resist interrogation, and that kind of thing, right? So it's military. And so for one of our training sessions, when I was a newbie, hadn't even graduated training yet, they were doing this training with us. And so they had put us in cold water. They would take a couple of us at a time and put us in this river, right? And so it's the middle of winter. It was like, I don't know, maybe February or March. So the water's really cold. We're in Washington. And they're quizzing you with questions, right? Like, this is the interrogation because, it's incredibly cold and it gets painful, right?
Yes.
And so you're just sitting there and they're not letting you go anywhere. You're sitting in this cold water with just your face out and keep badgering you with questions. And I wouldn't answer the questions. And I was started to get really drowsy. And then until I finally passed out from hypothermia. And just before then, like, I was feeling great. I was like, I finally got this warm sensation. Like, I was warm bath. And so all my muscles relaxed. And I'm like, oh,
this feels great, which is obviously dangerous with hypothermia.
I am perfectly happy, right? And I remember being in that kind of drowsy state and them asking me questions and me talking to this kind of high sing-song voice and just pleasantly drifting off. And, they, of course, then pulled me out and got me warmed up and everything. But that was my first experience. And so that first drift into hypothermia, I would have gone a very happy person. No worries. And it made me understand later why I would hear things where they thought that victims, survivors of sexual assault, they thought that that's what was happening to hypothermia victims, because they'd find them and they would be naked in the snow. They're like, oh, they must have been attacked and their clothes must have been ripped off. It's like, and then I was like, nope, they felt like they were on a summer beach somewhere and literally felt too hot and took their clothes off.
Right. Yes. Right? I've heard about that, if you're extremely cold and you start to get warm, do not take your clothes off, even though your mind starts to tell you different, which is what is one of the reasons why it makes it so dangerous.
Exactly.
Hypothermia.
Yes. Insidious.
I've heard the term like wilderness therapy like thrown around, and you're smiling, so I think this is like dear to your heart. Can you tell the people listening what that is and, what that means to you?
Yeah, because I just figured out what that was when I met you. I was unfamiliar with wilderness therapy. Yeah, I would love to tell the listeners.
Yeah, it's beautiful, and I'm pretty bummed right now, actually. At its simplest form, it's therapy in the wilderness, right? It's doing therapy, providing therapy for someone in the wilderness. That's what it might seem like on the surface, but really, I feel like it's the wilderness doing therapy. We instructors and the staff that would work in wilderness therapy out in the field, it's like we didn't feel like we needed to do all that much. The wilderness was providing the therapy. Mm-hmm. Because it's not, like you just mentioned earlier, it's not judgmental. It never judges. If there's a storm coming, it's not personal, right? If you got a huge river that's swollen and you got to cross it, there's nothing personal in this, right? The squirrel doesn't care. None of this stuff cares. It's just doing what it's doing. There's nothing personal about it at all. And so there's something about being able to go out, and especially if we've got troubles, right? If we've got things going on, if we're stressed, if whatever's going on in life, it's so beautiful to go out into a space where no one's looking at you. They don't care if you're wearing makeup or if you've got the right clothes or the right shoes. They don't, none of that matters. You can just walk out and do whatever you want to do, and you can survive or you cannot. And you can look around, and obviously the wilderness provides everything we need as humans to exist, or we wouldn't be here in this modern state. So it's got what we need. We just need to learn how to utilize it, how to take the gifts that it's giving us and use those in an appropriate way that's going to keep us alive. And hopefully in the process, give back as well to that landscape. So it's a beautiful process. And the therapists and the guides that are there are meant just to help ask the questions and guide you through that and help bring awareness around your patterns and what you do. Because I can't do the same things I would do when I'm at home, right? I'm not going, taking a shower and going to work or going to school if I'm a kid or whatever. I'm not doing any of those things. But however I handle stress is going to show up in the wilderness setting. Mm-hmm. So we would have students like, okay, you have to make a fire using bow and drill friction. And we'd have students that would get so mad and so frustrated, they would throw their whole kit, right, that they spent like days working on. They'd throw it in the fire and burn it up because they're so mad because they haven't gotten a fire, right? Is that useful? Right? Yeah. Is that a good pattern? It doesn't work, right? And if you're doing that pattern there, it means you're probably doing that kind of like slash and burn style back home too.
Yeah.
And so it's being able to, it's creating a new setting where there's new things and it's easier to see the patterns that we fall into when we're stressed and have this whole group that can mirror back. Hey, Jesse, I see when you get frustrated, you do ABC. And I see when you get sad, you do DNC. Right? And so we can see these different things. And it's like having a video camera on you all the time of people who are in the same boat. You're a video camera for them. And so you give each other feedback. It's all in this really different setting where there's no judgment outside. It's just beautiful. And I would see magical things happen out there. Just beautiful, amazing things happen. I never felt spirit as strongly as I did in wilderness therapy. Yeah. Just beautiful watching the connections, people that would come in at just the right time that were meant to connect and help each other. Sometimes they'd start off the trip hating each other, like, rah! But it's mostly because they're seeing in the other one the things they don't like about themselves, right?
Wow.
And so they would finally like come to learn how interpersonal relations and how to communicate better and heal the relationship and often then become the best of friends and help each other. It was just beautiful watching the whole progression, which was normally about anywhere, I would say the minimum was about 7 weeks out there and the maximum somewhere around 18 weeks.
Yeah.
Where they're out there full time with this group of people that just learns to love and care and support and all in this beautiful wilderness. So it's really amazing. And when I said earlier I was bummed, it's because apparently wilderness therapy, there was a show, like a Netflix show, I haven't seen it or anything, but it was about a bad wilderness therapy experience back in the 80s, right?
Oh.
Because there are ones that aren't good, right? People throw it up and they're just trying to make money and they didn't do. So this was back in the 80s and they did a Netflix series on it and it scared parents. And so they've stopped. And then I guess one of the Kardashians or something had an experience that she didn't like at wilderness therapy and has badmouthed it. And that's literally created enough bad publicity in the last year that the company, one of the companies that I think is one of the best wilderness therapy, is called Open Sky, best ever made. Is having to close its doors.
Wow. Like that is such a shame. That's really frustrating.
Yeah.
Because, you know, both Diana and I have felt our own form, we'll call it wilderness therapy, you know, hiking for 5 months for me personally in the woods. You know, you go through those same scenarios of, you know, these emotions and memories coming out that you have pushed down so deep. And, you know, Diana had the same experience. You don't know why they're coming out, why these thoughts are coming to the surface, but it's the nature's healing was healing us and exposing a lot of our flaws and insecurities and fears. And you have to face them because you're just out in the middle of, you know, sometimes nowhere. And what are you going to do? Like, you have to face them and you can't throw your kit in the fire. You have to figure out a plan.
You need that kit.
Yeah. So that's, you need that kit, girl. That's really sad to hear about that. Well, hopefully conversations like these help expose like a good positive light on things like wilderness therapy. I know we talked about it a bit with Callie as well, Diana. So, and hopefully enough people to listen to this and, you know, maybe go support a business that's still open trying to do that.
Yeah, you see hikers like when they end their through hike and they've been in the wilderness for a very long time, weeks if not months, how transformative that is for them and how their life moving forward is very different. And I think they feel like they can accomplish way more in life because they physically and mentally had to do this very tough thing in the middle of the woods. We're all humans. We all belong in the woods. That's where we came from, you know? So I feel like, yeah, just spending time in nature, I mean, that's not a cliche, but like literally like pushing yourself to do a hike or something like that is in a sense the wilderness therapy, you know, without the label. But yeah, both Jen and I think walked away from our through hikes like, yeah, I feel like I can do anything. I mean, Jen's raising two kids right now and she was just complaining about it before. And I was like, no, you can do it because how hard is motherhood? It's not that hard. You know, doing a through hike is tough.
I might disagree with you.
Yeah, I did just a little bit.
Jesse, I was introduced to you. I think I told you this when I met you on a Delta flight. Flying to Newark from Los Angeles, and you have a masterclass in survival and survival skills. And I sat there with my mom and I watched the whole thing, and you really readjusted my thinking when it comes to survival. Yeah, it just really helped me. And then I saw your class, and then like 2 weeks later, I did Mount Whitney, and there was a guy who got lost, and they ended up finding his body. Like 2 weeks later, we saw on the news. And I was like, if you just watched Jesse's masterclass, we have a lot of listeners who are gearing up for summer adventures. I would love it if you could just go through some steps. If a hiker did, let's say in the middle of summer, let's not go to the snow at the moment, but in the middle of summer, their Garmin goes down. They have no contact with the outside world. And they suddenly get really, really lost. Kind of like just some tips for them.
Yeah, a quick thing to keep in mind, a really important one, is that traveling, moving, especially if you don't know where you're going, is never a good idea. It's never good. If your flip has switched, your switch has flipped, let's put it that way. If your switch has flipped, you're like, okay, I'm no longer having fun. I don't know where I am. I'm injured, whatever's happened. As soon as that switch is like, okay, this is survival mode now. And hopefully you understand that that moment has to come, and you need to be aware of when that moment comes, because then everything you're doing needs to change. And one of the first things is, unless you are in immediate danger, stop moving. Stop. Over and over again, people start to feel panic, don't even recognize they're starting to panic, and they just keep walking. If anything, they walk faster. And if they don't, they're not on a trail, they don't know where they are, they're putting themselves in way more danger, right? We're using up so much more water, so much more calories, and we're much more likely to get injured if we just keep walking. And this was like from the Boy Scouts, that was common, quote unquote, wisdom. I have Eagle Scouts all the time say, yeah, I was taught in the Boy Scouts, you just keep walking. If you're cold, just keep moving. If you're not sure, just keep, no, right? That's how people die. They end up further out. They end up in horrible situations and dead. So stop. That's the first thing, is stop moving. Once you've calmed down, and when I say stop, you're going to use techniques to calm yourself down to breathing, exhales longer than the inhales. Make your eyes stay steady on one thing. If they're darting around, you're telling your brain that you're in danger. So don't let them dart around. Read a little bit of a book if you want to. Focus on a tree. Look at the clouds for a little while, right? Just sit down and relax. Drink some water. Let your brain come back into the frontal cortex. Because when we get panicked, it goes into lizard brain and we're not thinking rationally. So relax. Stop. Relax. Tell yourself you're not in any immediate danger right now. You've got everything you need to make it as long as you need to. You're okay. Once you've done that, now you can start to think rationally and start to assess. And if you really, truly have no idea where you are, hopefully you've done this soon enough where you can do a simple scouting technique, put up some kind of a flag, something right where you are, or notice something around you that you can look at that's you're going to find, right? It's a big lightning struck tree. No way you can miss it. You can see it for like a half a mile in any direction, or a small meadow, or something that's really recognizable. And now do a spiral around it. Make sure you can find it again. And once you're sure of it, now you're going to walk out in a straight line away from it and right back, and then choose another direction. Straight out, straight back, straight out, straight back. So it ends up, if you think of a bicycle tire, right? You've got the center spoke, and that's this item that you found that you will recognize from anywhere. And now you're doing the spokes, just coming out and back, out and back, out and back. And if you've done it soon enough, you're likely to find your trail, and you'll be good to go.
Wow, that's really smart. It's like you created your own home base.
Exactly.
That's your safety, essentially, in that moment.
More important, absolutely, to make sure you don't just keep drifting further and further to who knows where, right? So once you've done that, and even if you didn't find the trail, you've found resources. You haven't wandered who knows where. You haven't hopefully put yourself in danger. You're just slowly, rationally going one direction, coming back, going another direction, coming back. And you may find, hey, this is a great water source. Oh, I found a fantastic shelter site. I found an amazing signaling site.
Right? Yes.
So you're finding all the resources, if nothing else, that'll help keep you in good shape until rescue shows up. Most survival situations last 3 days or less. Okay. The average is 3 days. And that's with people who don't a lot of times know what they're doing. So making sure that you are knowing what's around you and just make yourself comfortable. That's really what survival is making yourself as comfortable as possible in an otherwise fairly uncomfortable situation. Right. And so if you manage to figure out, hey, okay, wait a minute. I remember my plan was I drove in on the road and the road was, I came up from the south and I parked at this parking lot. I remember I pulled off to the left. Okay, if I was heading north, I went left. Okay, so I went west of this major highway and that's where the parking lot was. And then when I left the parking lot on the trail, I continued west. I think I started southwest and I was going to circle around. But wait a minute. Okay, everything I was doing was west of that road. Okay. So if I'm in healthy shape, I'm in good shape. I've rested. I've thought about it. I'm in good shape. The terrain isn't terrible, even if I'm off trail, right? I'm thinking all this through first. Then realistically, all I have to do is go east. If I go east, I'm going to hit that road. I can't miss it. And so if I want to, and again, this has all been thought out, great, do that. If not, if you really, truly still have no idea where you are, or maybe you're severely injured or something on top of that, stay still, be big.
Be big.
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 Signal, right? Help search and rescue find you, right? So these can be pyrotechnic electronic devices, but you just said your Garmin's out, so you can't use it, right? You don't have any kind of electronic signal. Your cell phone may work. If nothing else, you can try a text or try 911. Try your SOS on your cell phone. That sometimes will work because they're required. All towers are required to carry an SOS signal. So even if you're in an area like my phone's not working, I must not have service here, there might be another tower within reach that can. So still try to use your phone or your electronics. So we've got pyrotechnic, electronic, and ground to air is a third large type of signaling. So put big things out on the ground, right, that are contrasting colors. And, you know, this is a whole lesson, but make yourself as obvious as possible. If you want to create white smoke from a fire, then get a whole stack, like pile about chest high next, about 20 feet from the fire, have a big old pile of green vegetation sitting there. And then you've got your fire going. If you hear or see a helicopter or a plane, take a big old armful of that green vegetation and pile it on top of your fire. And within seconds, it's going to start pumping out huge amounts of white smoke that are going to look like there's been a lightning strike or a forest fire going on, right? So there are lots of techniques to bring rescue to you. And that's the basics of what I would say to someone in the situation you just described.
Go ahead, Diana.
My reaction would be like, I'm going to be stuck here. I need to find something to eat and water. And that would be my first thing. But yeah, you thought the first thing you need to do because you want to get out of there is build a signal. That is like the number one thing. And yeah.
If this is truly like, you know what, I really don't know where I am and I'm going to be here until somebody finds me, then signal.
And it was very interesting. You were talking about food and water. How long can humans usually last without this? Because this kind of blew my mind.
Right. Yeah. Most, it's really funny when I go out to the wilderness, so many people, especially early days, they'd be like, you're going to go out there for a week. What are you going to eat? And we're so concerned with food in our culture, right? But we can 3 weeks easily for most humans, we can go without food. Yeah,
three weeks. So, that's crazy.
Yeah. And a lot of people, they did studies. I love this. There's a documentary called The Science of Fasting. And it talks about studies done in Russia and Germany, starting back in like the 40s and 50s, where they did studies on fasting to see how it affected the body. And some of it was they would go up to 40 and even 50 days without food. right? Or just like maybe a couple hundred calories a day. And they found amazing results, like health benefits from fasting that long. And so, and first it was psychological in one country, and then they realized there are physical benefits as well. So fasting can be really good for us, and we can do it for a lot longer than we realize. That's one thing. Don't get so hung up on food. Like I said, usually it's 3 days, right? And you're rescued. So food, not usually a top priority. Unless you have diabetes or some other kind of underlying medical condition, then you may want to always just make sure you've got some extra food on you, right? We can go a long time without food. Water, on the other hand, how long can we go without water, Diana?
Three days.
Yes. Beautiful, right?
Yeah.
Look at you, smarty pants.
I remember three. It's always three. Three, yeah.
Yes, right? So again, if your wilderness experience is likely last 3 days or less, especially if you're signaling properly, then you could theoretically, in a lot of conditions, go without water if you really had to. But our decision-making process really goes down when we don't have water available and we're not at optimum levels. So always nice to find water, and there are so many different ways to do it. But you really want to try to get on water as soon as you can and have some place to get that food. I could care less. And then, you know, it's shelter. Like whenever I get to a new place, again, it's the psychological health, not only the physical. And having your place to sleep, knowing you've got your shelter set up, it's going to feel safe and cozy. You've created some kind of a sleeping system, right? Where you've got lots of dead airspace around you that you can climb into, and you're going to stay snug and warm for the night. That's an emotional as well as a physical protection. And that's way more important than fire, right? So first your clothing, beef up your clothing as best you can. If you've got a sleeping bag, that's part of your clothing and equipment. If those aren't going to be adequate for the conditions, make a shelter, something that's going to keep the rain off or keep the wind out or the sun from beating down, right? Whatever it is, build your shelter appropriate to the conditions. And then if those aren't going to be enough to keep your body temperature where you need it at about 98.6, then go ahead and build a fire. Just keep in mind, fire is difficult. So it's your last line of defense, and we really don't need it. Most places we don't. I mean, you look at the animals. They don't need it. They've got clothing. Yeah, their clothing is like scales, blubber, feather, furs, right? Fur. That's what they've got as their clothing. And if that's not good enough for them in that those conditions, they find or they make a shelter. They build a nest. They, you know, peck into a wood, into a tree and make a little, or they dig a burrow. They make something. Or deer and a lot of your ungulates, they'll go and find a nice dense clump of vegetation and nestle down there on top of this wonderful bed of needles and leaves and with thick canopy overhead, right? That's what they'll use for their shelter. They can't do fire, and they seem to do okay.
Yeah.
So we can too. There are very few situations when a fire is absolutely critical, and too many people try to go to fire right away and end up dead before they can get the fire lit. They die of hypothermia before they can light that fire. So focus on your clothing, get it as dry and warm as possible, then do your shelter. And then if you feel like it, sure, go for fire.
So, man, I'm like blown away, because when you're talking about like if I felt lost, which I did get lost a few times on the PCT, but I always had my satellite, you know, my Garmin that I could refer to. I need to do things. I need to take action. So I would be that person that's like, okay, I would just start making mistakes and trying to go everywhere. I would, yes. But I think a lot of people are like, I can't stand here because I'm not making progress. But it's a good reminder. Like you saying that is like, you need to stop and you need to get control of your mind, and you need to, because this is what you need. And, you know, I've gone to some search and rescue like dinners and watched some speeches, and, you know, they say the same thing. Like the more you leave your area, it's just way harder to find that missing person. So I think a lot of people who even think about going, let's say, on like a day hike, like just, you know, a few hours, you know, nothing crazy, have been stuck. There's been many stories where fires have started. There's been multiple in Oregon. In, you know, recent years, where a fire has started, people were just out for a day hike and they got trapped overnight. And so even if you don't think you're going to be going back backpacking or whatever, what are just a few essential, like the top essential items you recommend for any hiker, backpacker, person going out into the woods should carry? Because you just never know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I got stuck on a day hike. That was my big thing. I was like, I have to sleep and I have nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, yeah, Yeah, go on, Jesse.
Yeah. Scary. Day hikes are definitely, as I mentioned in my class on Masterclass, are the most dangerous. And that's where people get in the most trouble because they're not planning and staying out overnight and they don't have the equipment. And so if anything, I mean, you know, things do happen. They go wrong. So making sure you've got your medication. So, you know, if there's a medication that you really need to take every night, every day, make sure you have enough for at least a couple days, even on a day hike, so that you've got it when you're out there. So that's one, critical medications. And what I'm going to be going through here is what I call the five basic needs. And I would love to just say, oh, take this, 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 and this. However, every environment is different. Every environment is different. And so what I need to take, what I would take in the desert is going to be different than what I'm going to take up at 14,000 feet in here in Colorado in the middle of January, right? Or what I'm going to take in Florida in to play in the Everglades in a canoe, right? So it really depends on the environment. So what I like to deal with is concepts. And so concepts with this, with everything at SEER, we would always work with the five basic needs. And it was a way to help the people we're training. They would come through an 18-day training and then they would never usually get that training again. They would get some updates and like a little refresher, but they would never get the full thing again. So we needed things that they could remember, right, really quickly. And hopefully later on then remember 15 years later when they're suddenly down behind enemy lines trying to survive. So five basic needs. So first, I use my fingers. One and done is signaling. You're always thinking about signaling. That's the one thing that really differentiates survival from ancestral skills or bushcraft or prepping or any of the other little things. Survival is my primary goal is to get out of here. I don't want to be here anymore. I'm done. I want to get out. You have limited resources as a survivor. Rescue, on the other hand, right? ATVs, helicopters, planes, dogs. They've got innumerable numbers of people willing to go home, get a good night's sleep, eat a meal, come out and spend 8 hours looking for you, right? They got all these resources. Give them a boost. Help them find you. So signaling always, if it's become a survival situation, it's going to be one of your top priorities, okay? So that's one and done, signaling. Two, your second basic need. Two is take care of you. So this, I want you to think of taking a personal care day from work, all right?
Oh, yeah.
I want you to think of like, I'm going to stay home in my cozy. I'm going to put on my warm, fuzzy slippers and my robe. I'm going to get myself a nice hot cup of tea or coffee. And I'm going to be, right? I'm going to be in my cozy little shelter, my home with a nice, in front of the roaring fire. And so those are the three things underneath personal protection. Another way to think of it is of taking care of you. Is thermal regulation. That's the primary thing it's focused on. Some other things add in there though too. So under clothing and equipment is your first line of defense under personal protection, right? My clothing is the first thing I'm worried about. And with that equipment can be things like rope or line, a headlamp, a knife, right? That's some equipment that can be really useful in those situations.
So for day hikers.
So even if it's just like, I'll give my students often a razor blade, just a straight razor blade. It's still wrapped in cardboard. It's been soaked in olive oil and then wrapped in a small piece of packing tape. And so that can act as an immediate action knife if they need it, right? If you're a trail runner, you don't want to carry a big pack or, you know, a huge survival kit on a day hike. Razor blade doesn't weigh much and it can literally make the difference. Like I can cut something or I can't, right? So it can be really useful. So having those kind of things. So again, so we're on the second basic need, personal protection. First one under that is clothing and equipment. If that's not going to be adequate, what do I have for shelter, right? And this can be as simple as a garbage bag, some kind of nylon, like a little bivy sack. I have a little bivy sack that's just a nylon bag that packs up to like a couple inches wide and a cylinder about 6 inches long. It's really tiny. And that's all it is a nylon bag. But if I'm out there and I need a sleeping bag, now I can stuff that full of debris. I can fill it full of punk wood, which is that light, like fluffy cork-like wood or leaves or needles. I can stuff it in there and it's become a, and then I wiggle in there and that's my sleeping bag for the night, right? But it wasn't a sleeping bag when I brought it. It's just this tiny little bag or literally just a garbage bag that you can stuff full of stuff. So that can become your sleeping bag and your shelter theoretically, okay, depending on the weather. If otherwise, I might take a space blanket, right? Or a small lightweight tarp that I can put up for a shelter really quick to block wind or rain or snow or whatever. Okay, so shelter. And then always have some sort of some way to light a fire. And that can literally just be a lighter. You don't have to do friction fire, right? There's no cheating in survival. So just have a lighter and maybe even a backup, right? Something that you know is going to work if you need to. And some kind of a tinder. Because if it's wet, nasty conditions, people have died because they may even have a lighter, but they didn't have anything initially that can burn long enough to dry out the other natural materials they find to actually light the fire, right? So that's your second basic need, personal protection. Three, I always say, go pee. So this is sustenance, yes. And it's food and water, but water is infinitely more important, right? So go pee. If you can't go pee, drink some more water. If you don't have the water to drink, go find it, right?
And I think you're going to say drink your pee for a second.
Well, I was going to ask, like,
never drink your pee. Oh, right?
That's what I'd be doing. I'm like, no. Surely this is the right decision.
No, you never have to drink your pee. We know we shouldn't be drinking seawater, right?
Yeah.
Ocean water, we know. We drink it. It dehydrates us. There's so many salts and minerals and things in seawater that the amount of water we get isn't even enough to flush out all those minerals and things we just got with it.
Yeah.
So if we shouldn't do that, we shouldn't eat food either if we don't have a water source available. Digestion uses up a lot of water, right?
Yeah. Okay.
So if you're out there and you got lots of food but no water, do not eat. If you eat, you're dehydrating yourself faster. I can go a lot longer without that food than I can without the water, right?
Okay.
So do not eat unless you have a water source available. And this also means, yes, urine has on average about half the minerals and salts of seawater, which is still far too much. Mm-hmm. And not only that, seawater has salts and things that my body might actually want. Urine is full of stuff your body didn't want. It's basically toxins and poisons it was trying to get rid of. It mm-hmm. didn't want it the first time, certainly doesn't want it the second time, right?
Yeah.
So if you drink urine.
I didn't really think of that.
Right? Well, yeah, you can just think about the morale of drinking pee. Yeah. you drink this and now your body is having to pull more water from your tissues, dehydrate you more to flush out all those toxins a second time, right? So yay, no pee drinking.
Woo-hoo, that's a relief.
So yes. You probably shouldn't eat poop either, right?
I mean, yes. Diana.
I'm just curious. Oh, I just
ignore her, Jesse.
Nope. You don't have to eat your poop either.
Curious. Survival.
It's wonderful. Man. Our survival situation's great.
Survival.
We're doing it for survival. Okay. All right. We're focused, Jesse.
So three is sustenance, definitely. Four is explore. So this is navigation skills. So either map and compass or like the scouting technique that I was talking about earlier of looking like a bicycle wheel, right? That's a type of navigation.
Yeah.
Knowing how to make different tools to help you in a certain environment. So like I've made some intense walking sticks for going down some really gnarly stuff, right? Or I may use ropes and carabiners and things to get down really steep or up slopes. There was a guy who fell into a beaver pond and he had stayed all night outside. If he'd used that time sitting around this icky fire with all this snow falling to make a couple of snowshoes out of the tree branches around him, he probably wouldn't have fallen in the beaver pond. He would have walked right on top and been fine. So making snowshoes. So there's different things you can make. That's all part of navigation, right? So that's four. And five is health. Stay alive. Five, stay alive, health. So, and this is that mental, emotional health, being able to calm down, recognize, have awareness around, woo, I'm feeling some anxiety right now. I'm feeling pretty panicked and stressed out. I don't like how this situation is developing right now. Recognizing that and using techniques to calm down. So that's the first part of health, mental and emotional. Second is everything having to do with hygiene, right? So for female, for menstruating, if we're how to keep, if you are prone to yeast infections and things, right? Just how to keep clean, pooping in the woods. How do we do that in a way where we're not going to contaminate our own water source or get flies or bugs or something digging it up and somehow getting contaminated, right? Whatever it is. So hygiene in general, that's part of health. And the last one is first aid, which is a huge topic, right? There's much that can happen. And so with health, it would be analyzing the environment you're going into. What causes people problems here? Are there bugs or not? Is it cold, right? Whatever it is. And so I use those five things, right? So I'll run through them again really quickly. Signaling, personal protection, which includes clothing, equipment, shelter, and fire. Sustenance, food and water, water being absolutely the most important. Four is explore, the navigation skills. So everything having to make sure you got a map and compass, you know what your emergency direction is if things go wrong. And five, stay alive, health. So making sure you've got critical medications with you and anything else that you think might potentially go wrong in that situation, including keeping your head.
Yeah.
Okay. So those are the basics and building a survival kit based on those. So whatever environment I'm going through, when I'm going into a new environment, summer, winter, whatever, I'm like, okay, what do I have for signaling on my person? What do I have for clothing, equipment, shelter, and fire on my person? That takes care of number two. 3, what do I have for water? Do I have some kind of, do I need water purification, or is it going to be snow out there and that's what I'm going to be using and maybe I don't need disinfectant, but I want a wide mouth water bottle. So every time I take a drink, I'm going to scrape off the dirty snow, fill it up with clean snow, put it next to my body, and that's what I'm using for water, right? So 4, explore. Okay, what do I have for my navigation stuff? Do I have a map and compass? Do I know how to use them? Am I going to use online? If I'm going to use my phone as my maps, okay, then do I have a backup battery, right? Can I take a picture of the map at the trailhead? Do I have an idea of what direction I'm going to go if everything goes wrong, right? So having those in place. And then 5, stay alive. Again, we've talked about it, right? What am I going to do for health?
I'm just curious about how long do you think it can take somebody to learn, like truly learn enough of these wilderness skills where they can maybe almost be on your level, like just confidence to be able to handle most situations?
You know, there's all kinds of levels, but I think that if people, even just listening to the podcast that you're doing right now, which thank you so much for doing, because one of my main missions is keeping people alive. But I feel like if I just have 10 minutes with someone to describe those 5 basic needs and a little bit about the order, and that signaling is super important, and to stop moving if they're in trouble, stop moving and calm down. Don't try to make decisions in that crazy panicked state. Just knowing that much can help save so many people. So many people have died because they didn't even know just that tiny amount.
Yeah.
So I don't, there's so many levels. I mean, I've spent 30 years,
right?
You know, and I learned what I learned in the military, and then I learned so much more working with other people and playing with ancestral skills and then working in wilderness therapy. So I've had a lot of time to kind of refine my understanding of things and to try to put it in very simple terms. But yeah, there is so much to delve into.
I can only imagine. I mean, yeah, you're talking about like making snowshoes. And I mean, I would love to learn how to do that. But basically what you're saying is we all don't have to be experts, but as long as we are maybe just continuing our education and, you know, starting like with what you just said, starting there and then hopefully building on top of that. I'm going to teach my kids this. I'm going to start teaching them. All right. If you get lost, you know, don't move, you know?
Oh. Yes.
Just bring them to the park and just leave them and just see what they do.
Yeah, watch. Yeah, see if you listen to me and Jesse Krebs. It'll be a whole thing.
Jesse, can you talk about a time that was really impactful for you, a time spent out in nature where you kind of thought to yourself, this is why I'm out here and this is why I do this for moments like this? Just a very impactful time. Anything?
Yeah, there's a lot of them. I mean, there's ones that I've learned from getting myself in trouble, being too cocky, especially when I was in my 20s and early 30s. I'm a survival instructor. I can go anywhere, right? And yeah. I'd go out and get myself in trouble. So I've had a lot of learning experiences. But I think one of the most magical I had was probably not smart again, but I went with my mom. She had rented a cabin on a lake in Upper Peninsula, not in the UP, not in the Upper Peninsula, but Northern Michigan. There was a big lake. I don't even remember the name, but it was a big L-shaped lake. And on the inside of the L, there was a big sandbar that went out almost to, like, it was only knee deep, like almost to the middle of the lake. And it was really cool. And mom and I we were just talking and having a wonderful morning, kind of walking along the shore. And we had found clay and we were wearing swimsuits and we found these different colors. There's gray and there's reddish and brown. And we started just like, you know, first it was goofing off, like slapping clay on each other. And then we started like, you know, drawing symbols and, you know, hearts and smiley faces, whatever. We were just doing cool designs and fun stuff on each other. And we're just talking and having a wonderful time. And we'd made it around that inside loop, the inside bend of the L. And I'd kind of noticed the sandbar a little bit. And then we kept walking and we realized, boy, it's gotten really still and really quiet, which usually in Michigan means there's a storm coming. And so we both kind of turn and look and we look behind us and there's this massive storm coming, right?
Oh.
Dark. Michigan does storms. Like, oh, I miss the storms in Michigan. They were gorgeous, right? Just saw these black clouds, you know, blue sky here, and black is just roiling toward, and you can see the lightning in the distance. And it's like, whoa. And it's really quiet and still, like everything's like, uh-oh.
Yeah, uh-oh, coming.
And so mom and I like, oh, we better turn around and start heading back to the cabin. So we turn around and start walking back and we come to that sandbar and I'm like, Mom, I want to stay here. I'm going to stay here and watch the storm for a little bit. And she's like, okay. And so she keeps walking. And so I'm alone. I'm like 16 at the time. And I just start walking out on the sandbar. And it keeps going and going and going and going. I'm like, wow, this is really cool. Like the sandbar just. And so I'm like basically in the middle of a lake as this thunderstorm comes in, right? And I'm painted with all these crazy symbols. And I just felt like this, I don't know, like
warrior princess.
Yeah, exactly. Like just, yeah, I'm Pocahontas. I don't know. I just felt like this, like, oh, this wilderness spirit sort of like energy. And I just start dancing. I start dancing and whirling and playing, and the lightning starts coming down, right? And the wind hits and this massive, and it's just gorgeous. And I was probably out there for a half hour just playing and dancing in this thunderstorm. And it was so magical and so powerful that was definitely one really formative, really magical time for me, for sure.
That was like on the Women on the Water, we canoed. And I was the only person to flip my canoe, which was dumb.
Typical.
I didn't even remember. If you hadn't said, I wouldn't even remember.
Oh, yeah. But I got back up pretty fast. We camped out on a little island one of the nights. And I remember there was thunder overhead. And, you know, I just turned to, I think it was you or Callie, I don't remember, but I turned to you guys and I'm like, I mean, is it safe to be out here like this? And I think you were like, yeah. And I'm like, okay. Sure. Like if it was anybody else, I'd be like, I don't know. But you're like, yeah, it's fine. It's just far enough away. But like, I remember some of the girls came up to me and be like, I don't think this is safe to be out here with this thunder like this. And I was like, no, they say it's safe. It's fine. It's fine. And like the girls are like, we're not going to sleep tonight. But that was a wild experience too. Like just, and all the girls pitched, you taught us how to build a shelter out of a tarp and with the knots and everything. And then, yeah, we went to this island and then we all had to build our own shelters. I did not partake in that because I had a one-person tent that weighed less than the actual tarp. So I was like, I'm just going to bring my tent and cheat. But so all these women, and they're all terrified because they've never slept under a tarp before, like in the wild like that, you know? And that whole thing was just, it was crazy. And then in the morning, they're like, that was amazing. Like they loved it. And so, but I was scared of the thunder a little bit. And I'm like, at least I have my tent and I'm not in a tarp. I felt so, but you were just like, yeah, it's fine. I was like, all right.
You're talking about lightning. What, because exposure to lightning is some of the most dangerous aspects of through hiking. Sure. Diana's laughing because
our experience, we had an experience with lightning, me and Jen.
Well, yeah. It was dumb. So I like don't even want to tell you, Jesse, but we were hiking the Tahoe Rim Trail, which is, you know, a trail around Lake Tahoe. And in the summer, yeah, they get some good thunder and lightning storms. And one was happening and I'm like, we need to keep getting low, you know, or like we need to keep decreasing our altitude and, you know, whatever. And Diana convinced me to go to this ledge to take she's a photographer.
Yeah.
And to take some footage of this like lightning storm coming. And I literally thought we were going to die.
Yeah. Jen's like, we're dying. We're going to die. We're running to this ledge. We're going to die. And we hear it and we're going to die. We're going to die. And the pictures were amazing, but that was scary.
It's not smart. We told people, we're like, do not do this. We dropped our packs and, you know, I brought my Garmin in case, but she convinced me. Yeah. But I told her, I was like, I'm never doing that again because it, like, I know. Yeah. See, oh, we're making Jesse Krebs. She's cringing. Diana. <Yep. laughs> So anyway.
Great. Yeah. It's not worth it.
It's not. It was really scary. But yeah. So you're talking about you dancing, you know, with the storm coming. So for our future through hikers or backpackers coming into this summer season where there are a lot of thunderstorms, what can you do about lightning? If you just get hit with a lightning storm out of nowhere, because they do come out of nowhere sometimes.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And not only lightning itself, but then they can also start fires, which then become a whole nother problem too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So lightning, getting lower elevation immediately if you can, and also trying to go on the side opposite the direction of the storm, which is usually going to be going down the east side. Most of the weather in the United States comes from the west.
Okay.
So if you're seeing storms and paying attention is going to be the first one, right? And it can be very distant. I had a friend who was hit. She was teaching a climbing course for girls, and then been climbing for most of the day. And they had another hour or so of climbing, But she saw far in the distance, it looked like there were clouds coming. She's like, you know what? We've had a good day. I'm just going to go strip the climb and come back down. It was blue sky over top of her. The storm was miles away and she was hit. Like wow. Lightning out of a blue sky. Oh, and went was unconscious. It was cool. The photos were amazing. I mean, she's fine. She has two kids now. Her pants, her
what jeans a story.
Were shredded. I mean, they look like fringe. You know, like she had made her jeans into fringe.
Oh my God.
She had the cool pattern, like all your blood vessels like pop out. Like they look like a vein tattoo, sort of like it looks like lightning strikes all over your body. It was really wild. But she survived, right? She was okay. She had a couple of burns where she had like equipment and stuff. But anyway, so the main thing is try to get down, right? Try to get as low in elevation as possible. And part of like with our situation, Diana, there were big trees.
Yeah.
Just like there was that little ditch kind of in the middle of the island. And then there were big trees over there. And we were in this area where there were a bunch of little tiny trees. And we're not, right? It's like if anything's going to hit, it's going to hit those big trees over there. It's not coming for us. And so looking for a bunch of little trees like that, don't go underneath big, thick canopy. Okay. That's what happens to a lot of people is they think, oh, I want to stay dry. And so they'll go underneath dense vegetation, which usually means the biggest trees in the area. And if you go underneath those, that's what's likely to get hit. And you don't have to have a direct hit. A lot of it is actually, it's the ground splash, right? So lightning is actually coming up from the bottom as well as down from the clouds or the sky. And so it's sort of meeting in the middle. So you getting to staying away from those larger trees. But if you're touching the ground and there's enough charge there, you'll still get struck basically, even if it's not a direct strike. So stay away from those larger trees. And for us, again, out on the trip, like we would, during wilderness therapy, always plan to have all the shelters are at least 20 feet away from each other. CPR is not usually effective, actually, right? Cardiopulmonary resuscitation usually doesn't work because something's caused the heart to stop that, like it was bad eating, right? Something's wrong with the heart. But when it's a lightning strike, it was just the electric shock kind of like stunned the heart. It's like, whoa, what was that? Yeah. And it stopped. And CPR is actually very effective at bringing people back if it's a lightning strike. So if you've got 20 feet between those shelters, right? If one group of people is struck, the others are not likely to be struck. And if they know CPR, they can go in there and actually get the heart started again.
Wow. So, I would have never guessed that.
Yeah, they had a really like beautiful example of that where it was Boy Scouts. I think they were Eagle Scouts. They had just gotten their Eagle Scout whatever and CPR training like 6 months or a few months before this. And they were all up at altitude and they were all in a group and got struck. They were out in the meadow and were the highest thing in the meadow. And the whole team was struck. And there were only a few of them up still standing. Like I think even both of the leaders, the scout leaders were down, right? The adults. And this group of like three or four boys ran around to these other, there were like a dozen of them on the ground, unconscious, no pulse, no breathing. And these kids got in there and saved, I think, all but two of them.
Oh,
like got their heart started again. So it's one of the times when it's very successful. So if you have to hike, if you're like, here comes the storm and I've got to hike down and you're with a group of people, spread out at least 20 feet between you. And if some people know CPR and some don't, have one person that knows CPR at the front, one in the middle, one at the end, right? And spread out at least 20 feet between you. So if anything happens as you're trying to get out of the path of the storm and the lightning, you've got that backup, right? Where somebody knows how to start hearts. And then when you're building your shelters, if you think it's a lightning prone area, hopefully you're not building in a lightning prone area. But if you are, you're building your shelters again, at least 20 feet apart for that purpose. And then insulate yourself from the ground, ground splash.
Right. I was going to ask about that. When I was hiking the Pacific Crest Trail, I was hiking up Sonora Pass when a storm was coming from behind me. So I was just pushing on. I was hiking so fast and I have these pictures of the clouds were like black and you could hear the thunder and I could see the lightning and it was like right above me. I was alone. I hiked the trail alone. So I started sprinting because I was following the trail, not sure what to do, but I was getting like a little panicky because it was coming up on me so fast. So I was completely exposed. Like I was at the very top. And I was just running for miles, you know, to get kind of down. But there was a female hiker. I don't know who she was, but she was like kind of taking shelter. But she put herself on one of her it's like a Thermarest Z-Lite pad. And she was just like sitting on it. I just kept sprinting. But I learned maybe if like the lightning was there to just get on top of my pack, like put my pack on the ground? Or is that effective? Or is what she was doing effective?
It's better. The more insulated material you have between you and the ground, the better.
Okay.
And taking a lightning position, like if you feel like it's really imminent, like I remember, again, really stupid, being on the edge of Canyon de Chelly and there's lightning going all around and I'm with a friend and we're talking to each other and her eyes keep glancing above my head and above my head. And I finally look at her really quizzically, like, what are you doing?
What are you looking
She's
at?
Like, I'm sorry, Jess, but your hair.
It was...
Yeah, like a cartoon. Oh. And then I look closer at her and realize hers is doing the same thing. And we're standing there laughing at each other. Right?
That was Diana and me, like, telling me to calm down on top of the lightning mountain. I'm like, no.
Yeah, look at my hair.
Yeah, let's continue, though.
It wasn't dramatic, but it was like all these individual strands. Wow. And one of our friends came up and go, hey, you idiots, you're about to get struck by lightning. Can we get in the car?
Yeah.
You know? Like, oh, yeah, you're probably right. Right. So if you feel like it's imminent, like any moment, because this is, it's a hard position to hold for a long time, but you can get in what's called lightning position, which is putting something between you and the ground. Those foam pads are awesome.
Okay.
Even the inflatables could be okay. You're just trying to get space between you and the ground and preferably something that's rubber or non-conductive, right? That's what you're looking for. And then squat. The best thing is to squat with only your toes, basically, or your feet on the bottom of your feet touching the ground. And then put your elbows or your arms, connect them to your knees.
Okay, that makes sense.
And the reason for this is, yeah, it's to skip the heart again. Okay, so if lightning hits, my brain actually will probably be fine. And then it's going to find the fastest way to get to ground. And so if I put my elbows on my knees, it'll go from head through my arms to my elbows through my knees, through my shins down to the ground.
Okay, so my hands would have to connect to my face? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Well, not really, because it still would go down your shoulders.
I see.
Right?
Okay.
Down your arms, right? So from head, shoulders, arms, down to your knees, down to the ground, and hopefully skip the torso, meaning skipping the heart, and less likely to stop your heart. Because especially if you're alone, yeah, there's no backup there, right? For somebody to come and help your heart start back up if it doesn't do it on its own. So that's lightning position. It's just, again, very hard. You know, if it's a storm that's lasting several hours, have fun trying to hold that position. But if nothing else, and that's where making sure your shelter is an area where you don't have a big, like, oh, this tree's got two lightning strikes on it already. Probably want to stay away from that one, right? And it's the water, right? It's the water in our bodies and things that are more of a problem. And like part of like on our trip with being on water, I would really love, and anybody listening to this podcast, owlskills.com, send me an email. I don't know of any situations where people were hit while being on the water.
Interesting. Yeah.
And to me, it makes sense because water is such a huge reservoir and such a good conductor. So if lightning hits that, it's going to, one, disperse really quickly and be absorbed by all that water. So, and why would it go for any person on the water to connect to the water faster? Like, we're so close to the water already when we're in a craft. So I would really love to hear if anybody knows of that, because I've never felt in danger when being exposed on the water like I would in a meadow. Because in a meadow, I'm more water than the dirt underneath me. And I feel like the lightning would be more drawn. It isn't drawn to you, but you're a convenient pathway for where it would.
That's fascinating. If anybody writes to you and like shares their experience, we might follow up with you so we can follow up with the listeners and let them know. You know, just educate them. We're all about educating, right, Diana?
Yeah.
We are all about educating. Yeah.
Yeah. I would love to know if like somebody's been on a boat, had lightning literally strike the boat and then had like a bad experience, because to me it would just go through the boat and go into the water, even if it hit the boat. I'm really curious about that, like if someone's seen or knows of people getting killed or what the statistics are. I would love to know that.
You talked about the owl skills. Do you want to briefly, you know, talk about that and how everybody can connect with you?
Yeah,
sure.
Do you got some classes coming up?
I do. I have some classes coming up in March. March will be my first one. I have like one day, and I'm in the Denver area, so these first classes will be here. But yeah, I go up and do things with Callie sometimes in Montana, or Carrie Lee from my season of Alone. She's in Idaho, or Timogen and I, who was on my season as well. He's the survival doctor, so he does things. He's Canadian, so maybe do some classes with him somewhere. I go to Vermont fairly often, so I kind of travel around. And my school is called Outdoorsy Women Learning Survival Skills, so hence Owls Skills. But don't be worried if you're a guy. You can also come. I occasionally do classes for all demographics where the men are invited as well. And I'll do anywhere from a one-day class. Sometimes I'll do workshops in different places. Sometimes the one-day class will cover basically all of the five basic needs real quickly. We'll give a quick overview. Other times, one-day classes will focus on just one specific skill, like sheltercraft, firecraft, navigation, whatever. And then I'll do weekend courses where usually it's Friday through Sunday. And we spend two nights out. So if you're a beginner hiker or just never slept outside before and want that, it's a nice, safe environment to do that. And we don't do a lot of hiking on either the one day or the weekend courses normally, unless it's a navigation course, because it just eats up a lot of time. And there's so many things to learn.
There's so much. So,
yeah. It's a lot of fun. So, you don't have to be really physically in shape or anything. You don't have to be oorah, like, oh, it's going to be, right? We come together. We have fun. I try to teach you and help you be as comfortable as you can during that time. And then I also do week-long courses. And I do private courses as well, so custom courses at any length of time, as well as just look at the website, sign up for a class, and come play.
It is okay. Playing. I mean, yeah, you always, even the course, you're like, oh, you guys, it's time to play. And we're just like little like kindergartners, even though there are some women in their 50s, they're like, time to play. And you're like, all right. And then you're like showing how to like make fire and stuff. And it was, yeah. But I think too, a lot of people, their excuse for not getting out into the nature is, well, what happens if I get stuck? What happens if this? And it's really just all purely education. And once you know, then that comfort sets in and then your world kind of opens. And then, yeah, you feel good about being out there. And yeah. And thank you for all you're doing with teaching, you know?
And we're going to put all of the links to like your website and the courses in our, podcast description. But I want to ask Diana, do you feel like you could go out and you could survive?
I knew you were going to ask me this. I was like, she's going to do something.
For one day, one night.
Jen, I hiked the PNT. I was alone for like 3 months. What are you doing?
Like you lost your satellite. You have no food and water. Could you build yourself a shelter? I couldn't. So.
Well, I'm going to be honest, Jesse, I really struggled with the knot tying. We learned a ton of knots and that's what I struggled with the most because I just, ADHD, I can't process it. I got the majority. I think the shelter would be my trickiest thing.
Me too.
You know what I have going for me? Because I know because I got stuck on a day hike where we were lost for almost 6 hours and we're like, we're going to have to sleep out here and we had nothing. My number one thing I have is my peace of mind. I can calm my mind very fast. If I get in a situation, I almost like, well, this sucks. I don't panic. So it might take me a little bit longer to build the shelter. It might take me a bit longer to get the fire going. But I do have that peace of mind. I know it'll work out. Like, let's just be calm about it. Whereas, yeah, some people, when they start panicking, but they do have the skills to like build the shelter. But if you start panicking, that all goes out the window.
You can't think about it, right?
Yeah. What about you, Jen? Do you think you could survive?
I want to learn more about how to build a shelter. That's why I love the show Alone, even, before. I'm just fascinated. But it's – I think my main thing with even this conversation and speaking to other people that we interview, Diana, and Jesse, it's just that everybody started from a place with no knowledge at one point in time. And so it's really intimidating to think about people who can do all of these amazing things, whether it's sailing around the world or being able to survive in the wilderness. All these people didn't know all that information at one point. So I just want to learn. It's really intimidating to think about, but it's like, I can do it. I can learn how to, make a shelter and survive. So I'd love, we should just like watch some YouTube classes, Diana.
Well, I saw Jesse too. Like, I remember this, like we're all sitting around the fire during this course and Jesse's like, all right, we're gonna learn how to make a shelter. And then like she has a tarp. And I think one of the girls is like, well, how are we gonna do this? And Jesse's like, well, you gotta find a way. And then she gets out this axe and she just starts taking down trees. And I'm just like, oh my God. And then she like builds this thing. And I'm like, oh my God, it was amazing. But yeah, that was funny. I was like, she's out there cutting down trees, building this shelter. And I'm just like thinking about a hotel. And it was.
Yeah, I need to take some of these classes. I really want to.
You gotta do it. It's transformative. Like this wild woman on the water, it's transformative. And like going back to how we started this conversation, like women crying, like not wanting to leave. And we're talking they were living in the woods for like a week, like coming from the city, and like they didn't want to leave. And I remember I'm going to call out Stella because, I mean, she was funny. She was great. It was such a wild experience, and I'll literally never forget it for the rest of my life. Like it was wonderful. Yeah. And I was very timid in the beginning, even though I've done some, you know, I've lived out there, but still like the level that you and Callie are at is just a whole nother level. Like your comfort out there is just, it's very inspiring. It's like, wow, like there really is no reason to panic when a storm, you know, like there's no reason to panic. Like just figure out what you need to do, do it. And it'll be fine. You know, so it was great to be around presence like that, the calmness in the wild, like, because usually all my friends, I'm in Los Angeles, so all my friends, you want to do a day hike and we turn a corner wrong and they're panicking and we can see the city, like we see the buildings. And so it was nice to be in the presence of real, like, I guess, wild woman. I, you know, like you and you're like, you are real life wild women. So yes. It was cool.
That's like the best. Yeah, that's the best compliment.
Yeah, you know,
it is, absolutely. And we all are inside, you know. I really think of it as just pulling that to the surface. And that's what's empowering and beautiful, is realizing that, especially I think for women and marginalized demographics, it's like we are often told for most of our lives and what we see on TV. And it's getting better now. But especially when I was a kid, you didn't see women doing what I do or what Callie's doing. You didn't see that. And so I think for most of us, you know, that are getting older, it's like, that wasn't our example. We didn't have that. And we were told that the wilderness, in many ways, we were told it's not for us. It's for these, you know, usually white men with beards.
Yeah.
that's who it's for. And you other people are just going to die if you try to go out there. And so it's really so empowering to break that stereotype and break those bonds that are just self-imposed or imposed by society and that we accept it. And it's like, no, I don't have to accept that. I am. We all, right? It wasn't just men living however many thousands of years ago out in the woods. It was, of course, the women and the children, everybody. Like, that's just the way it is. I think of going to see the Hadza and walking out and seeing a new, you know, a month old baby. Oh, a month old.
Yes. With the Hadza. Jen, she went with Callie. Remember Callie was talking about the Africa trip and she got to stay with the Hadza? Yeah. Jesse went with her on one of them.
Yeah.
Wait, can you just very briefly just tell us about your experience with that, because it's a very unique place. And
I mean, it's really like stepping back in time and just seeing how humans used to live with the land. And it's beautiful. And I have to share one funny story with this. Was we were all sitting around Alex, gorgeous blonde, she's in her 20s, right? Legs. And she's, so all the men are like, hi, Alex. You know, they learn Alex's name first. And she's beautiful and intelligent and wonderful. And she is holding a book on her lap of birds. It's different birds in Tanzania. And she's got all the men of the tribe are around her and they're just fascinated by this book, right? They don't see books very often. It has very detailed pictures of the birds. And they're going through and they're talking back and forth and they do the click language, right? So we don't understand anything that they're saying, but we have a translator and he's trying to kind of talk and you can see by their motions. And so somebody's putting our hand over Alex and pointed at this bird. And oh, no, I think it's that one. You can tell they're arguing about things. And one of the boys, right, they're like, they start learning archery at like 4, right? They get a bow in their hands and start practicing. And so you've got these like 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old boys and they're shooting anytime. Their belief system is that if God puts something in your path, you're supposed to shoot it and eat it for dinner.
Wow.
Like to not do that, God just gave you a gift and to not take it and eat it is disrespectful, right? So they're constantly shooting anything that comes in their path, right? They are the top predators in their environment. And so they're pointing at all these birds and you can see there's a kind of an argument breaking out of two birds that look very similar, of this one or this one. And they're you know, making the calls and everything. They know so much about every species there. And one of the boys like pulls a headless bird out of his pocket and holds it up to the picture. And he's like, no, see, blah, 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 blah. You know, see, it's this one. I was right. It's good. See the markings and whatever. And we're just dying laughing, right? And this happens like two more times where different boys are pulling birds.
like dead animals out from their pockets. Yes.
And it's like, we have a candy bar.
Yes. Yeah, like a Snickers bar.
Later, exactly. And they've got the birds in their pocket. I just thought we were just dying laughing. We're like,
I love that story. But it just shows you, yeah, how different people live across the planet. Those poor little headless birds. Rest in peace, little birdies.
You know, hey, they were lunch, you know, the hounds have survived. That's
that must have been in a Callie was, she talked about it on the podcast about this the last real tribe in Africa.
They're the last, they're one of, there might be another tribe or two somewhere in the world, but they're one of the last true hunter-gatherers. Yeah, there are like 167, I think, tribes in Tanzania, and yeah, all of them are pastoralists or farmers, except for the Hadza. And they're in bad shape right now. Unfortunately, there aren't any specific things to help the Hadza. And the Hadza, they are the root of human experience. Like hunter-gatherers, from what we can tell, are how we started, how we began. And so they are being shoved out of their areas, even areas that are supposed to be for them. They're migratory. They follow the animals. And so they'll leave one area intending to come back in like 6 months, 8 months. And pastoralists, even though this land has been literally pulled, like put aside for the Hadza, they don't pay attention. None of it's enforced. So pastoralists, a tribe will come in with their herd of goats and cattle and say, oh, nobody's here. And they'll put up huts and start grazing their animals and shoving out the wildlife. Mm-hmm. So now when the Hadza come back, their water sources, like all the water there smells like animal manure.
Yeah.
Right. And there's hardly any wildlife anymore. It's all goats and the vegetation's all been stripped. And right. So it's really sad watching what's happening to the Hadza, and they're having to learn commerce, and they don't have any way. You know, like they can't come back into an area and say, this is our land.
Yeah.
The way they've survived the Hadza is by running away. Escape, run away. If people move in, they just move to a different area. They can't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm. There's not enough land.
Everywhere has all these pastoralists. So there's nowhere else for them to run. And so they're being forced to like make jewelry and sell it and join the commerce. They're trying to learn Swahili. And even then they don't know laws. They don't know. They can't go and petition the government and say, hey, you said this was for us. They don't even know a lot of times that it was meant for them. Right. So they don't have advocates, and a lot of money that goes towards nonprofits and things to help tribes in Tanzania, most of it goes to the other tribes. There's nothing specific for the Hadza. So it's really heart-wrenching watching what's happening to them, because they are an amazing, beautiful, sweet, strong, proud, capable people. Like no one knows the land and the wildlife like they do.
It's really
beautiful.
Yeah,
that's heartbreaking. And you said that there's nothing specific that outside people and forces can do, correct?
They could. It's just nobody is. They've just been left behind. They're so shy, and just they don't like to make a fuss. They like to disappear. And so they're learning how to adapt. Like right now, a lot of times what they'll have to do in these areas is the farmers. There's corn everywhere. There's sunflowers, right? Lots of fields. And of course, like the more goats you have, right? The more goats and cattle you have, the richer, the wealthier you are.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what it's doing to the environment. So everyone, all these pastoralists are trying to have as many animals as possible, because not only is it security, it's also wealth, which means it's just doing devastating things, right, to the environment. So what they'll do is say, hey, I've got a boar, right? I've got a family of wild boar that are eating up my sunflowers over here. So the farmer will come out and say, oh, the Hadza are here right now. Great. There's a family unit. They'll go out to that family unit and say, hey, we've got a boar over here. You can take it and eat it. Just get it away from my sunflowers. So they've started kind of brokering deals that way, where they try to help each other out. But again, that's only going to last so long, right? Once the wildlife is eliminated, it's eliminated. And what the Hadza then either have to completely dissolve their way of life and just get encased and absorbed by the others, or not, and die off. So it's a tricky situation right now for them.
Yeah. Wow. I'm surprised the government doesn't buy land for them. They should try to protect them and do
guaranteed
something.
There's no Hadza representative in the government. You can be guaranteed that, right? Again, 167 tribes in one little country.
Maybe they need you.
It'd be great. So much going on, but yeah, you know,
come on. Another thing.
Kind of a nonprofit or something.
yeah,
that can buy land. Oh, and that's another thing. You can't, like, I would love to just go in and buy land over there for them. But you can't. You have to go through somebody who lives, who's a native, who's lives in Tanzania. So, and then it gets tricky, like, okay, who do you know well enough to give money to then buy the land and then think that they're actually going to keep it for the Hadza? Like,
right.
Unfortunately, a lot of the people that, there's very few people that speak the Hadza language, but those that do, a lot of them feel like, well, they're doomed. Their tribe is just going to go away anyway. So it's not really, they, if you gave them money, it's not likely they would actually fight for the Hadza. Okay, let's get them into school. Let's start. They would just make that transition happen faster.
Yeah.
That's really unfortunate.
Well, I think awareness too, just talking about it. I mean, maybe somebody's listening who has, oh, well, I have a rich uncle that lives in Africa. Let me get him involved, you know?
Awesome.
Like, you never know. So just like talking about it is good and getting the word out. And yeah, we talked to Callie about it. And it is quite fascinating though. Like seeing the pictures, I saw photos of you out. It really is a different world, but it where we came from, you know, like that's it. That's, you know, so it is, it's like something from the history books. It's almost it, like, yeah, these pictures were taken hundreds of years ago, but no, it was taken like last week. I would love to venture over there one day, maybe on one of, I know Callie does trips over there, and that would be an amazing experience. I would, yeah, bring my camera. They would, little kid pulling birds out. I'll trade you. Anyway, okay, yeah. Jesse, we got to let you go.
It was such an honor to meet you and talk to you. And hopefully one day I can meet you in person. I'd love to do some of your classes. You know, my youngest is 6 months, so I just need to wait a little bit longer, you know, before I can leave for a bit. But I am totally going to be joining some classes. Before we go, is there anything else you'd like the listeners to know?
Oh, don't be afraid of wilderness. Get out there and have fun. Like, learn some skills. Again, even just listening to this podcast, you've got a big step up from most folks that go out there. And if you just focus on some basic principles, you'll survive. You'll make it fine, even if something goes wrong. So don't let it stop you from getting out there and just playing. It has so much to offer.
Yes. I love that.
I love that.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jesse. It was such a pleasure.